Hell yeah. Welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast. Today's guest is someone who's been on the show a couple times before. It's my homie Frank Lopez of Submedia. And Submedia just dropped this awesome documentary about hip-hop, about radical hip-hop, as part of their Trouble series. And I don't know, I was just watching it, and it just got me really fucking pumped. And so I wanted to have Frank come on and sort of dig a little deeper into the film, why he made the film, and just kind of talk about some of the stuff in there and talk about some of the artists and give a little more backdrop on some of the artists that he talks about in the film, and to kind of get him to talk about, you know, culture as a weapon, as a vital, the vital role it plays in our movements, and how it should play a bigger role. And of course, I have a duck in this race because we're talking about hip hop, and it's something, you know, it's what radicalized me. It's what radicalized Frank. It's what radicalized a lot of people. And I know I mention it in a lot of interviews, but, you know, it's just something Scott Crow said to me a long time ago. It's like, if you were to ask anyone in any, at any conference or at any, you know, on a riot line, and you ask somebody like what brought them here, what radicalized them, and so many people will say music. And so we're going to talk about how culture is devalued in our society, and the sort of context that hip hop arises from. And I like to hear people like Frank or other radical hip hop artists sort of put language to, you know, to something I feel, but I don't really talk about a lot because I am so invested in it. And another cool thing that sort of comes out of this documentary is just this idea that there's actually, there are more people making radical hip hop music than ever. And it does play a bigger role in our movements than it used to. And what are the points of intervention? How can we expand that? So yeah, it's a fucking awesome interview. And I figure I'd shout this out now. I just signed a contract today for a book that's coming out. It's called Insurgent Rap. It will come out in 2020 with an awesome anarchist publisher. I'm not going to say who the publisher is until the deal is finalized. But I'm really excited about it. And so this interview will also be a part of that book. And Insurgent Rap is just sort of, you know, conversations with underground, socially conscious, radically minded artists, you know, just talking about rap music. So I'm really excited about that. And yeah, so if you want to support Frank's work and you want to support Submedia, I mean, they got four people working over there and they could always use more resources. Go to sub.media, donate, sign up, become a monthly sustainer for their project. They need support because, you know, shit is real. This is, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into making this stuff. I mean, I don't know how this crew manages to continually just put out so much great, great stuff. If you don't subscribe to the Soulcast in iTunes or Stitcher or wherever else you listen to podcasts, please go do that. If you do it, rate it, review it. It helps more people see it. I just dropped a new mixtape. It's called Nuclear Winter, Nuclear Winter 3. It's a free download on my Bandcamp, so go to soul.bandcamp.com and you can get a free download of that mixtape. It's got a lot of like 90s rap songs that have remixed over the last few years and made into political interventions. And yeah, that's about it. I'm trying to do this every 2 weeks now, just maintain a rigorous schedule of releases, so stay tuned. I got a lot of shit coming up over the next forever. And yeah, thanks for listening. And before we go ahead with this interview, I'm going to play a little jingle from some of the comrades in the Channel Zero Podcast Network.
Hi, my name's Eamon Farrelly, and I have a podcast. How original, right? It's called Radical People, and it's about radical people. Basically, I sit down and I interview people who I find very interesting. Interesting why? Interesting because they took a look at the world around them, saw a need, saw a problem perhaps, and they decided to address that need or fix that problem. How? With direct action. That's right, not by begging the dirty government and its politicians and bureaucrats, and not by lobbying corporations to please, please, please stop being so awful. No, they get together with some comrades or some homies or just whoever, and they implement whatever solution they see fit, however they see fit to do it. So, that's my podcast. I listen to these people's stories, which turn out to be sometimes very funny, sometimes very scary, sometimes harrowing, always edifying, sometimes titillating. Actually, I haven't had one yet that's been titillating. I know, like, making things a little sexed up generally sells, but typically when people are, those are ISIS soldiers, it doesn't get as sexy as you think. Or maybe it does, and they just haven't told me that part yet. So anyway, you should listen to my podcast if you just happen to be really bored, or on a road trip, or you just need to drown out what's going on around you. Check out Radical People by searching for it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or by checking out the Channel Zero Network. So yeah, that's my commercial for my show. Thank you for listening to my commercial for my show.
And when we die, we will die with our hearts unbound.
After the 2016 election, a lot of us woke up to some harsh realities. In the aftermath of dark events, I came back to political work with a new sense of urgency. But after a few months of showing up to protest every weekend, I started to burn out. It didn't feel like anything was changing. In fact, maybe things were even getting worse. And it got me thinking, what comes next? Rebel Steps is a podcast about what comes next. You'll hear episodes on letter writing to political prisoners, practicing mutual aid, and creating political art. You'll hear the voices and stories of my community in New York City, spotlighting a range of organizers from the Metropolitan Anarchist Coordinating Council, NYC Books Through Bars, Anarchist Black Cross, Lower Manhattan Food Not Bombs, Brand Workers, and more. I'll walk you through what you can do to start plugging into movements and learning organizing skills step by step. If you've been to a march or two and you're looking to jump in, this podcast is for you. Or if you have friends looking for more, pass it on. Listen at rebelsteps.com, on iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast.
Motherfucking Frank, motherfucking Lopez, welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast.
Thank you very motherfucking much.
How you doing today?
I'm good. I'm caffeinated, ready to put in another day of work, enjoying the fall colors, as you would say.
Yeah, I was just saying on the phone, you know, it's been a while since I lived in the Northeast, and I'm really taken by the foliage. It's just beautiful this time of year.
It's the fucking best. It's the best time of the year.
And it's crazy, you know, I'm only 6 hours away from you, man. Like, don't be surprised when, you know, me and my family end up on your floor. It's coming, man.
Dude. I had to go to Maine. It's been like over 30 years the last time I went to Maine. So I'm gonna go roll up in your spot too, and then, you know, we can do some cross country skiing.
No, I mean, but yeah, man. Anytime, man. We're kind of out here in the woods, so it's like I don't have a lot of comrades out here yet. I mean, I'm sure I will, but we've only been here 2 months, so it's kind of. It's lonely, man. Come visit.
Right on.
So yeah, I was, you know, I like last week or whenever you dropped it, I watched your new Trouble series, and You Don't Stop, the hip hop documentary. And I was, you know, sometimes I've been rapping for so long that sometimes I just get. I feel like a lone voice crying in the wild, and you know, I'm bitter or whatever, and I just watched that documentary, and it made me feel a, sort of a renewed sense of purpose about what I was doing. So I just wanted to, you know, thank you for making that film. You know, it's cool because it's always going to be there, and sadly there aren't enough films like that. You know.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that, and all I can say about that is just the little bit that I can give back to hip hop for all that hip hop has done for me over this, I don't know, 30-year love affair that I've had with this cultural movement, which is how I like to refer to it, and not just a musical genre. But I should posit this. I should note that this was done by our crew here at Submedia. So I was only a small part of this documentary. It's four of us and the crew. So we busted ass to make this film, and we really actually took extra care in making sure that we did it justice, right? Because this is hip hop is huge. It's hip hop. We never thought that it was going to be this, and. I should certainly hope that we can do our best to honor it, but also to help steer it in a more positive direction.
Well, let's just, you know, start from like the beginning. You know, all these documentaries you've done in this series have been about, you know, serious activism or revolutionary work, whether it's like hackers or, you know, just environmental resistance, like whatever. And so to make one about hip hop, I just was like, damn, you know, that's pretty cool. So I guess, can you talk about like why specifically y'all wanted to make, a documentary about hip hop in the lineage of all these other revolutionary films you've made?
Right. I just think that, in our scenes, very unfortunately, cultural production is undervalued. And so most of what is produced in terms of art and music could it be poetry and, you know, whatever you call it, painting, poster making, I don't think those things are valued enough. I think that we value information and hardcore, like organizing work and direct action more than anything else. But
you mean we as activists and radicals?
We as activists, as anarchists, as shit disturbers, people who just want to change the world. And, you know, I think that we forget that the soul of a human being is a hugely important part in sort of sustaining long-term militant work. If we don't take care of our soul, we're in for a very short career as people fighting the good fight. So, to me, like art is important in my life. I certainly don't engage enough with it as I should, and every time I go see a show, every time I go to see some nice pieces of artwork in a museum or at a gallery space that my friends will be doing a showing, or if I go see some graffiti on the streets, like all those things help me move forward. You know, help me just they pump me up. And even, you know, like one of the things that I'm battling as a person who's coming of age getting older, I should say, is I have a hypertension, and so I exercise to lose weight so that I can, you know, try to drop my my hypertension and stop taking blood pressure pills and whatnot, and I use hip hop to like be the motivator for me to actually go on runs. And so we want to start touching upon subjects that are not just like, let's talk about police brutality, let's talk about prisons, let's talk about blockades, but let's also talk about hip-hop, let's talk about punk music. We're going to have an upcoming episode on mental health. All these things that I think that not enough attention is given to, right? And so we hope that the hip hop one is just the first in many ones that we do on not just cultural production, but other subject matters that I think activists don't focus on enough.
Yeah, like parenting. You're going to do a parenting one?
Holy shit, that's a huge one. Yeah, no, yeah. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it was just as you were saying, I was like, oh, because people, like lately in interviews, people have been asking me about like self-care because they think I'm like so happy or something. And I'm like, actually, I was kind of depressed last month. So I don't know if I'm the one to ask about that. And it's just funny. You know, life is funny like that. You know, I was like, did a gratitude meditation like the other day, and I was like, I actually felt better afterwards. I was like, oh my God, what have I become? Like, am I, oh God, like somebody shoot me. But that's life. We got to live, you know, we got to live and fight.
So. You know, I don't think there's any shame in that. And I think particularly burnout is something that our movements suffer a lot from. And I don't think enough people actually take the time they need to sort of like, you know, empty their soul. Right. And when I think about hip hop and when I think of where it came from, when I think about the misery that people were living in the South Bronx around that time, it really makes me think of this Mos Def song called Rock and Roll. And I don't remember the lyrics exactly, but he's talking about his grandmama living on a reservation and his ancestors living on the plantation, and how they sang songs for inspiration. They sang songs for relaxations. They sang songs to get their mind off of their fucked up situation. That's basically the lyric. And this is what music is for a lot of folks. It's a break from the shitty reality, you know? We all deserve that break. We all owe it to ourselves. You know, we're all busting ass in this really incredibly difficult time that we're living in right now. And we need to be able to sustain over the long term. And that's what music is. It's a meditation, just as you went on your gratitude meditation.
Hey, you know, the only reason I laugh about that is because my wife has always been like, you need to fucking meditate. And I'm always like giving her shit, you know, and like, being like, oh, yeah, whatever. So in that vein, can you, it's something that I never really understood until recently. And I'd like to hear you speak on the sort of, I mean, you touch on it in the film also, but can you talk about like the Bronx as a failed state and as like a, you know, like the conditions that hip hop arose from? Because I don't think people really know its roots. You know, we don't know it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can speak more directly to my own sort of family experience. My dad was born in the Bronx, and he spent part of his youth there. And he was part of that generation that's very stereotypically depicted in the musical West Side Story. You know, he was part of that diaspora. At least his mom was, and my grandma. And, you know, the amount of racism and poverty that the Puerto Rican community had to endure in that neighborhood alongside a black community was incredible. You know, my dad is probably the toughest person I know because he had to survive that shit. So in the 70s, the Bronx was almost like the forgotten borough of New York City. You know, there was tons of fires that were happening. Whole city blocks were being set on fire, not just by street gangs, but also by landlords. It was a state of extreme poverty, drug addiction. Meanwhile, you know, just south of Manhattan, you had, you know, more luxury, more if people understand the sort of like geography of New York City, it's just right below is Manhattan. It's like you just cross a bridge, if I'm not mistaken, and you're in this completely different area. And these were also in the school districts here, my understanding is that there was not like musical education in the schools themselves. And so, you know, people who come from a background from being Puerto Rican or being black, having music always being played in their homes, whether it be like soul records or R&B records or whatnot. And in the case of Puerto Rican people, also like salsa and merengue and other musical genres from Latin America, people didn't have access to musical instruments in their school or whatnot. So the turntable sort of became that musical instrument. And it was sort of like a very ingenious way of, you know, taking these turntables, taking these sound systems, many of them, but that got looted during a very famous blackout where people were able to break into stores and just steal a lot of speakers and a lot of sound systems. And people started throwing parties and playing the music that they liked. And out of these parties, people started getting on the mic and doing chants for the crowd. And then people started essentially rapping. You know, people just started talking, making up stories, just freestyling, talking about their lives. A lot of it had to do with talking about the opposite sex, you know, trying to flirt while using the mic. It's just kind of unbelievable to think of that this sort of like very basic putting together of sound systems and microphones and house parties became this thing that, you know, has come to dominate, you know, musical charts, that dominates. It has a huge place in global popular culture right now. Comes from this particular moment in time.
Yeah, it's like the hacker ethic. You know, it's so. It's like, as you're talking about it, it reminds me of like a petri dish or something, where like all the elements are there, and then, you know, this thing just evolves. It's incredible that human beings have that capability in them, you know, to just invent something like that. It's and then to see it today, that's cool, man. I've never quite heard it put that way. And then another thing you talk about in your film, again, this is something that I just didn't really know shit about, was like how the Zulu Nation arises from this context. Can you talk about like Zulu Nation and the sort of like the relationship between that and the local gangs and sort of Pan-African liberatory sentiment that was around in the air at the time?
Yeah, so I don't know if anybody's seen the movie The Warriors. For those who haven't, you know, it's a fictionalization of the sort of many, many gangs that inhabited New York City in the 70s. And it's a fictionalization, but it comes from a very real historical fact, is that there were many, many gangs in the city, and also in the Bronx as well. They all look almost exactly like they did in the movies. They're all wearing like cut off jean jackets, and you know, the names of the gangs are scrawled on the back. And so there was a lot of gang to gang violence, you know, for territory, for turf, and whatnot. And the Zulu Nation, headed by Afrika Bambaataa, sort of comes out of that scene. Comes out of the gang culture. And sees hip hop as a possible vehicle for stopping street violence, and getting young kids who might go the route of gangs into a more positive direction. And so, you know, from this, you see like people using breakdancing as a way to sort of battle each other in a way that's more constructive. That doesn't include like killing each other with knives or guns or whatnot. MC battles also sort of arise from this sort of culture of instead of joining gangs and showing your superiority through violence, you do it through your superior like MC skills and whatnot. And so yeah, Afrika Bambaataa very early on saw. A very real possibility of like sort of taking this art form and using it as a way of grassroots organizing in the Bronx. And I think this is hugely important, because I think hip hop is still being used as a way to grassroots organize, but not enough. I think that people who doubt that this is possible should see that the roots of hip hop come from a grassroots organizing culture from very early on. I should say this is incredibly sad, but Afrika Bambaataa has been sort of disowned from the Zulu Nation for sexual molestation allegations by members of the Zulu Nation. It's incredibly sad, but we have to take the good with the bad, and that is something that has to be talked about, right? Not to say that his contribution wasn't positive, but like, you know, that's where we're at right now.
And yeah, and I guess the other thing to add to that is, like, you know, in the midst of all this, like, people, you know, these house parties, like, a lot of it is like in abandoned, squatted buildings with, like, you know, stolen, hacked power from the local electric grid. I mean, that's like, you know, not to like ascribe a certain politics to it, but that's some, you know, some anarchist shit, man.
Yeah, I mean,
small A anarchist shit.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, I do think that we have to be careful about how we as anarchists gonna use that, because, you know, I mean anarchism is something I identify as an anarchist, but it's definitely like a very Western way of describing something that other people have been doing for a long time, right? And yes, it is very anarchistic, but I think that those black and brown folks in the Bronx, you know, they own that shit, you know.
Right, totally.
Nobody gave them a zine.
Yeah, they didn't hear against me and make that choice. Yeah, I mean, well, that's another thing about your film is I think is Sima Lee one of the only artists that identifies as an anarchist? And like, a lot of the artists you focus on in your film don't necessarily identify as anarchist.
No, for sure. Sima Lee definitely does. Mare Advertencia Lirica, the female MC from Mexico that we interviewed, while she doesn't identify as an anarchist, she went to school at the Sección 22 school in Oaxaca. And that's a school that's run by Magonistas. So these are folks who these are anarchist teachers who they call themselves Magonistas in honor of Flores Magón, one of the creators of the Mexican Revolution, who him and his brother were anarchists. And so there's definitely like an anarchist. If she doesn't identify as an anarchist, there's definitely, like, you know, she comes from a long lineage of, like, sort of anarchist schools and education in Mexico. I don't know if Lee Reed identifies as an anarchist, but he's definitely on our team.
I love that guy. His music is so awesome.
Yeah, he's
great guy.
He's incredibly underrated, and I think I would love for more people to listen to him. But, you know, all the other folks sort of like bring their own sort of very autonomous politics to this documentary. And Loke and La Marea definitely are for indigenous liberation. And Mike Crenshaw, you know, he's got a long history of like anti-fascist organizing, right? And so he's definitely rubbed shoulder with the A team.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing about the film is, like, can you talk about that? Can you talk about how, like, the decisions to choose the people you selected for this film? Like, you didn't, you know, I didn't see you trying to get the biggest, you know, the biggest names you possibly could. You honed in on people with a certain politics.
Well, because we wanted MCs who are involved in, like, radical grassroots organizing. We didn't just want people who are good at rapping or who are famous, but we wanted people who live their politics. So, for example, like Sima Lee, she's part of the Maroon House, which is a house in Washington D.C. That you know, the day that I went to visit her to do the interview, they were giving out like free water to people walking down the street in this neighborhood in Washington, D.C., and it was a day that it was 105, 108 degrees Fahrenheit. But they also have, you know, they also collect food. They give food, and also they have an event space. And so there's there is, you know, there is that element of being a hip hop artist, but also being like deeply entrenched in the place where she lives and her comrades live. Having a physical space in a social center. I don't know if anybody who lives in a city where there's no social center, you know why those things are sorely needed when you don't have them. Well, I think that particular project is super interesting, not just insofar as like having a place for events, but also a space to be able to collect donations for food or clothing for people who need them. They also have like a food garden. It's a super inspiring project. Antloc has been doing grassroots support work for at-risk youth in reservations in the United Snakes. Really, when we talk about at-risk youth in reservations, you want to talk about the most depressing and sad story that there is right now in the United States. You know, lots of suicides. Lots of drug addiction at a very early age. So Antloc does a lot of that work, helping these youth. La Maria Vuelve, I've known her for a long time. She does a lot of indigenous solidarity work. She didn't speak a lot about it in the film, so I don't want to like talk about what she does. Unless she wants to explicitly do it, she hasn't done it yet. And Lee Reed is hugely involved in the anti-gentrification battles in Hamilton, Ontario, right now, and he released a full record just to support a rent strike that's been going on over there. So that was the sort of flavor that we wanted. You know, people who have conscious lyrics, you know, who are not flaunting how much money they have, who are talking about some real shit and who are also doing some real shit.
Yeah, that's awesome. You went on tour with Savage Fam, 2011 or something, or 2010 or?
No, I went on tour with them maybe 3 years ago, I think.
Because one of the things we were talking about earlier that I thought was interesting was how their approach to doing shows and like how they interact, I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, so the first show that we did was in Oakland in a space called Quilombo, really cool space. And one of the things that really struck me was that around the end of the show. No, was it around the end or the beginning? I don't remember. I think it was around the beginning of the show. These kids roll up to me and say, "Like, look, we want to rock the mic." And you know, I mean, I was like, "I don't know who you are. I don't know if you're any good." You know, I wasn't saying these things, but I was trying to be diplomatic about the whole thing. You know, I was like, you know, I don't think this space. You know, we're pretty tight. You know, and all that stuff. And one of the members of Savage Fam was like, "Oh, hell no. These guys are going to take up the mic. These guys are going to rap if they want to." And so they sort of flipped my shit. And instead of being about, like, let's just have the polished MCs who have a lot of experience up here, the Savage Fam did their show. And then they started playing some instrumental tracks. And they let these kids rock the mic, good or bad. And it was so awesome, not particularly because these folks were any good. It was just about giving them that shot, you know. I got to rock the mic after a Savage Fam show. It was a crowd. It was a pack house. Everybody was cheering them on, you know. And I think that in terms of encouraging people, especially people who are marginalized, a lot of the people who rocked the mic were women too. I think that we don't see enough of that, and their way of doing that particular show was very, very inspiring. And I'm hoping that more people get to do this and give younger folks an opportunity to jump on there and just try shit out, right? But the other thing was that when we went to Portland, Antlok decided he didn't want to do just like a straight up like Savage Fam show, partly because he had busted his ankle playing basketball. And so what he decided to do is he decided just to do like a full a cappella show with his son, who at the time was like 12. I think his son is an incredible MC, and other members of the Savage Fan crew. And that was amazing, completely like a cappella. And in between tracks, he just opened the conversation to folks in the audience to talk about indigenous resistance, to talk about what it is, what it means to be a settler. And so it was a very unconventional format, but it worked, and people stayed to the end. So we ended up doing it like that for the rest of the tour. It almost felt like people reading poetry and then having a conversation about what they just heard. And for anybody who knows Savage Fam, like, their lyrics are incredibly uncompromising. They don't really, there's no bullshit there. They're very direct. And so for people who've never really been able to have a conversation as settlers talking to indigenous people, it was like an incredibly good icebreaker. And it was a great way for people to ask questions that they've been, you know, curious about for a long time. And so, yeah.
Yeah. And that's powerful. You know, I think people don't want to make themselves vulnerable or sound stupid or whatever. And, that's cool that they were willing to, you know, allow a space for that. That's awesome. I mean, you almost wouldn't imagine that when you see their videos where they're like got AKs and, you know, it's awesome. I know we share a love for a lot of like early 90s hip hop stuff. So I guess I was curious if you could speak on sort of like some of your favorite, most influential, rap music of the mid early 90s or 80s or whatever, whatever Public Enemy or NWA or mainly Public Enemy, I guess, to start. Can you kind of talk about their work and like what it meant to you?
Yeah, that's it. Public Enemy was the rap group that, Public Enemy was the rap group that I credit a lot for being the person that I am today. You know, obviously there's many other factors, but hearing a musical group, talk so brazenly against the government and against police and for the rights of black folks, was mind blowing to me. You know, it's just, you know, like when you're young, you think like, oh, you know, are these things legal? Can you actually do that? Can you talk about, you know, using a gun, and your music? You know, these are all things that, you know, we sort of don't think are very shocking right now. And, in this era of very well armed mumble rappers on YouTube, right? But like back in the 80s, it was definitely controversial, and Public Enemy was a very brave group, you know, like to be putting this music out there at the end of the Bush, at the Reagan era and the beginning of the Bush One era, and you know. Back then it was cassettes, and all their cassettes had their lyrics, you know, in very tiny type. But I would sit there and listen to their cassettes and you know, try to read along with the lyrics to see what the fuck they were talking about. Because to be honest, the first thing that I loved about Public Enemy before I came to love Chuck D's lyrics was the Bomb Squad and Terminator X and the Shockley brothers, you know, that team that produced that Public Enemy sound, was, you know, it was noisy. It was groovy and annoying at the same time. And I think that is the thing that music can do, that film can't do, that written text can't do, is, it can enter your heart. You know, you put your guard down and then all of a sudden you're grooving to this craziest beat you ever heard in like fucking 1989. And next thing you know, you're like, what the fuck is this guy talking about? And boom, you're getting some really radical black nationalist lyrics. That shit is genius, you know. Not only were they incredible at their sort of music and songcraft, but also the whole look of the band was amazing. You know, it was like you got Chuck D kind of wearing like kind of traditional hip hop garb, you know, baseball hat, kind of bomber jacket, but also the jacket with this huge, incredible logo in the back that features like a black youth in the crosshairs. You know, it's basically, you know, the name itself, you know, Public Enemy, like black people are Public Enemy number one. And then you have Terminator X that looks like he's from outer fucking space. You know, he's got these massive glasses, you know, Terminator X being the DJ. And then the S1W, Security of the First World, it was just this crew of folks who were just like almost like their onstage bodyguard. I mean, it was definitely like a show, but you know, they looked like Black Panthers. You know, they had like that sort of Black Panther militant look with the berets and whatnot. And then Flavor Flav, probably my least favorite part of Public Enemy then and now, being sort of the joker, the buffoon, you know, trying to give some sort of comedy breaks to like Chuck D's like very like deadpan and serious delivery of some very heavy lyrics.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's so funny, man. I was just like, as you're like going through all that, I was just remembering like, you know, I listened to that music and like, I'm in like eighth grade or something, you know, writing a, you know, went out, bought my first Malcolm X hat, you know, writing about the Black Panthers and it really, really set me on a path. And I think it did for a lot of people. As you were talking about like the production style of Public Enemy, like it was making me think about, like, this is sort of an abstract art question, but I'm just going to throw it in here because it's interesting to me. It's like, you know, the Situationists always, or Guy Debord would always write about like new forms of film, new forms of media that were capable of like confronting the spectacle. And as you were like talking about all that, you know, and because one of my questions was about like the medium being the message. And like, do you think it's really important? Do you think like the visuals of a band are like really important? Do you think like, because I'm always torn on that. I feel like it's like, in a way, it like takes away and detracts because we live in such an image society. But like, and like, does it take away from the realness? Like, do you have an opinion on that? Like, how much, you know what I mean? Does it have to be a performance?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I'm just as you're asking it, I'm trying to figure out, like, for example, one of my favorite hip hop groups is Tribe Called Quest, and from my memory, they don't seem to be, at least in the 90s, they didn't seem to be doing anything very much over the top with the way that they were presenting themselves on their music videos. I unfortunately never got the chance to see them perform live, which is a travesty. So Tribe Called Quest came with a very real, very earthy, sort of down to earth hip hop style with Ali Shaheed Muhammad, like their producer. Like, he is like gotta be like my top five like hip hop producers. So I think that they delivered, you know, a musical, you know, I hate to use the word product, but a musical, whatever. Let's just call it that for lack of a better word, like a musical product that didn't need any bells and whistles. Like, their shit was just so awesome that was enough, you know. But then you had like folks like De La Soul who came like, you know, just maybe like a year or two before them. You come from the same sort of like the same school of hip hop. You know, they're all friends as well. And De La Soul definitely was pushing a visual style, right? But the visual style of De La Soul was definitely also a political statement, right? Because one of their lines was like, De La Soul from the Soul, Black Medallions, not no gold. You know, they were trying to say like, we're not into the bling, even though it wasn't called bling back then. And so a lot of their a lot of their style was to basically say, like, we're not into this consumerist, like, jewelry shit. So we wear these, like, black medallions that usually had, like, the continent of Africa imprinted in them, or some sort of, like, black nationalist imagery. And definitely, like, the colors that they chose to wear were more colorful. So like, they were basically, like, trying to break from this sort of, like, tough guy, like, hip-hop image to a more sort of, like, artful and I would say even soft image. So it just I don't know. I guess it just depends on your project, right? Like, what it is that you're trying to do. And maybe the look also affords you another possibility to deliver other messages that maybe doing it through your music is not enough. I don't know, but then yeah, if your music is dope, then like Mos Def, for instance, like I think the Black on Both Sides is one of the best hip hop records ever made, and I don't see Mos Def being all like showy, you know. I think he's pretty straightforward.
Well, you know, also though, that's his career was sort of in the period of time of like the boom of independent hip hop between MTV and now, when visuals didn't really matter, you know, when you could kind of just focus on your art. But yeah, I hear what you're saying, but actually, you know, but in general, I think, you know, the reason I ask is because you're a filmmaker, you know, Submedia has always had a really strong visual aesthetic. All your, you know, when you make documentaries, y'all do not make them dry. You make them, you know, like, you know, the medium is, you know, the aesthetics are important to y'all. And it's not just about the content of the film. It's about the, you know, communicating through images. So in, no matter what, you're communicating something as an artist, whether you're wearing a hoodie or a medallion or a Raiders jacket.
Yeah, no, I think you make a really good point. But I think that maybe this more completely answers your question too, in terms of, like, you know, the amount of things that we have to compete. We're basically on a huge, you know, global competition for people's attention. And we are, this is something I've said many different times. I probably said it the last time I was on your podcast, excuse me. But we have to, you know, do the best damn job that we can to get people's attention, produce the most quality content that we can produce, not just you know, in our films, but, you know, you with your music, anybody who does like written work, whatever it is, we need to do the best possible work, because we're competing with, you know, multi-billion dollar, you know, corporations that are spending, you know, mad money on their productions. And 9 times out of 10, people would choose to watch Netflix over us. You know, 9 times out of 10, people would choose to listen to Jay-Z instead of listening to MC Soul. You know what I'm saying? And so we, with our small budgets, we have to make fucking miracles. And, like, you know, even when you look at Savage Fam videos, you know, I honestly don't know why Savage Fam is not bigger. Maybe it's because it just crossed that line too many times where it makes white people way too uncomfortable. But, you know, you look at their videos and I'm not going to assume, but I think they take a cue from Public Enemy. Like, they have a logo that they're flashing on screen anytime they get, and, like, you know, that shit works. Like, I see that logo, I think, for Savage Fam, you know, and their videos that definitely have an aesthetic that is very much, like, attached to them. And so I think at these times, like, you know, all bets are off, you know. Let's, you know, aside from, like, being sexist and you know, and shitty, I think that we gotta use every avenue possible so that we can reach people, because yeah, if we don't, we're dead.
Well, okay, so you just mentioned the sexism. So was it, like, I feel like you navigated it well in the film, but was it difficult, like, as somebody who actually, you don't listen to quote unquote mumble rap like I do. But was it difficult to, like, navigate that without sounding like some moralizing old fart?
No, I don't think it was difficult to navigate at all. I mean, I think that, you know, we're all feminists here in the crew, it's a no-brainer, you know. It's like, I don't listen to racist music that talks about like killing Puerto Ricans, you know. And so why would I listen to music that degrades women, you know? I think people need to start like really like drawing a very, very hard line on that shit, because, you know, most men could say like, oh yeah, but I don't believe it. It's just that the fucking beat is groovy or whatever. And it's just like, you know, if they were talking about like killing Puerto Ricans or you know, or talking about Puerto Ricans in a despective way, I would be fucking outraged. And I think that women are outraged that this shit is mainstream. They're outraged that this shit is on the radio. They're outraged that children are listening to this shit. And I think that we need to really step up and share their outrage and just say like, fuck no, like this shit has to go.
And it really has an impact. I mean, when I grew up, you know, like, you know, as a kid watching like Boys in the Hood, like for the 1,000th time, like me and my friends really talked about doing drive-bys. Like we were serious about doing a fucking drive-by, and we didn't actually think about like the fact that somebody would die. And you know, I, as a kid, like we would, you know, use the word bitch, and it's like, it's disgusting to think of it now, but it's like the shit has a serious fucking impact. I mean, look at rape culture. Look at Donald Trump as fucking president. Like, clearly, we do need to start drawing those lines, like hard lines.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, on that tip, you know, when you were like, I'm currently working on a book about hip hop, and I've really struggled to find female voices in the United States that I could highlight. And so I was like really happy to discover Sima Lee through your documentary. Her music is fucking awesome. Like it just politics, everything. It just, I was very grateful to discover her through your film. You flew to DC to interview her. That was the only place you flew for this film, right?
Yeah.
I mean, do you want to talk about like why that was important to you, or?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's just what you said. It's the voices of female MCs are not valued as much as the voices of male MCs, and unfortunately, the sort of more popular female MCs that are just sort of blowing up are women who are extremely sexualized in their appearance, in their music, in their lyrics. And, you know, I know that for a lot of folks, like there's an aspect of like sexual liberation in women taking power, very much like Madonna did, like back in the 80s, how she's been like sort of seen as an example of a strong woman. And I celebrate that. But you know, let's be real. I mean, some of this shit is like ridiculous. Some of this shit is just really meant to sell records. Some of this shit is not about politics. And I think people need to be honest with themselves about this shit. And so MCs like Sima Lee, that, you know, I mean, I'll be honest. I was like, fuck, not only is she dope, but she's also an anarchist. Like, I want to see more of this stuff, you know. And even if people don't consider themselves anarchists, you know, even if they're pushing like, you know, liberatory politics, I want to see that, you know. Some of my favorite MCs are not anarchists. Some of my favorite groups are not anarchists. Depress are not anarchists. The Coup are not anarchists. Fucking Bamboo, the best shit out there, but he's not an anarchist. I tell you who I would have loved to interview is Ruby Ibarra and Rocky Rivera. Like that crew, the Beat Rot Records crew, that whole crew are putting out like incredible stuff, and they have... They give a lot of space for their female crew members to put out shit. I would have flown to fucking L.A. or
Antarctica.
Or Oakland or Antarctica. I would have flown to Antarctica. You know, I mean, the truth of the matter is that when the majority of the time, I mean, our budget is tiny at Submedia. You know, we budget about $600 for videographers. So basically, we pay people $100 to do a shoot. For a lot of people, that's not enough to make a living. A lot of folks actually do help us out because they understand that we don't have a lot of money. And in DC, like, yeah, we tried. Some folks were just like, yeah, I can't do it for that much money. And so we felt it was important really to have this voice. So we made an exception, and we flew down there and shot Sima Lee. And on the process, we also shot a bunch of interviews for upcoming Trouble about the J-20 trial.
Yeah, I love the that Ruby Ibarra video is just the illest shit.
I think it's called Island. Well, I think part of the lyric is Island Woman Rise, but I don't remember if that was the name of the song. But that I love that track.
Yeah, I love how you just keep. There's definitely a couple of references to it in the film, which I thought were awesome.
Filipino rap. Filipino rappers. That's the thing. You can apply it. Hip hop is so universal. You can apply it to sort of any cultural context. You know, the way they mix English and Tagalog in the rap is just I fucking love it. Even though I don't know what the fuck they're saying, I'm just like, this shit is fucking dope.
Well, you know, it's you know, you say that, and it's like I think about how like my experience of the world is totally through this sort of whatever Euro lens. Like that's where I had solid distribution for my music, and so I could always just get, you know, it was easy for me to get bookings all over Europe and Russia, like through the, you know, a whiter world or whatever. And so like these are my references, because that's where I've been. Like no one's ever tried to bring me to Mexico or Brazil or anything. But one thing that always struck me is when I go to other places, whether it's France or Greece, I mean, especially Greece, like in Greece, they have Antifa hip hop, like, you know, Antifa hip hop squats. And this was, you know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, where you'd go there and there'd be like anti-fascist squats based around hip hop. And so you'd have all these Antifa rap groups and anti-racist rap groups. And it's a huge, you know, cultural thing all across Europe, like to have like social centers that are based around hip hop and, radical politics. And, I just wonder, like, why do you have any thoughts on, like, you know, why that is, why, like, this idea of, like, you know, radical hip hop has taken root so much in other countries and less so in the United States from like the perspective of like social centers and shit?
Well, I mean, like, I think the Greek example is that there's a very specific context. I've been there. It's got to be one of my fucking favorite places in the world. Never have I felt like anarchists have so much power in one place. But I do think that the social movement there are extremely strong, and they see the value in creating space for the sort of cultural production, you know. One of the best things that I saw in when I was over there is that they had this party in this little mountain, like mountain park, right next to Exarchia, which is like a neighborhood where there's a bunch of anarchists who live there, and you know they're raising funds for political prisoners, and they had like a DJ just spinning, you know, political punk music, you know, so it's like this massive dance party, and they're selling booze to raise money. So, I mean, obviously they don't have a license or whatever. There's like over 1,000 people at this party and no permit, you know, nothing. You know, the cops are not crazy enough to show up at this party. So everybody felt like, you know, this is chill. Nobody's going to fuck with us tonight. And I think that our movements in Turtle Island need to sort of value music more as a way to sort of amplify our messaging and also bring new people into the fray. I mean, But I also think is I just don't think that that record labels really see a lot of value in political music. You know, we see a few examples here and there of bands that blew up with a very radical message, but those are few, far and few between. Like, and I don't understand how that music industry works. I actually absolutely hate it for the type of stuff that they're constantly putting out there, like the garbage that they actually put out. But like, I mean, I think about a group like Dead Prez. Like Dead Prez is incredible. I mean, I think their ability to make sort of like gangster rap with like sort of very politicized lyrics and with like really good music behind it was fucking genius. It was genius. And why wasn't that press bigger? I don't know. Like it's just something that sort of boggles the mind. But also why don't we have hip hop squads? Well, I mean, we don't have squads for a number of different reasons. But why don't we have like sort of like houses that are more oriented towards hip hop, as we have like a lot of places, like for instance here in Montreal, there's a massive punk culture here, right? And like how do we take that punk ethic and mix it with hip hop? Is that something that's possible? It sounds like from what you're describing from Greece that's basically what's happening, right? It's like people who love hip hop taking a note from anarchists and punk cultures and creating something like a bit of a hybrid, right? Maybe the thing that we should asking is like not so much as the why, but how can we make this happen? How can we just take this musical and cultural movement and sort of like and try to take it back and try to use it for our own purposes, right? One of the things that that I did when the crew finished the documentary was that we emailed all the artists and we included all the artists in the thread with their emails visible, and we said like, y'all don't know about each other. Get, you know, here's all your contact information. And everybody was stoked. Everybody was like, holy shit! Like the same thing that you've been telling me that you were not aware of certain artists, like Lee Reed and Sima Lee have totally hit it off, and like Ant Loc wants to come to the East Coast to do a tour. And so maybe that's one of the things that's missing is that network. You know, how do we build that network of like-minded artists, since there's not that many of them? And then when we do discover new ones, say like, look, I love your music, you know, look, there's this other crew of people who are on your same tip. Let's connect you. Let's get you doing shows together, or at least collaborating on tracks. You know, I mean, I think there has to be something a little bit more proactive. Think about this. Like, an artist who once was known as Alas came to Montreal, and so many people love her here. Like we don't get that type of political hip hop through here a whole lot, and of course she packed the fucking house. There's this anarchist rapper from where's she from? She's from Honduras. I really wanted to have her on the documentary, but she wasn't on tour, and she came to Montreal and she fucking packed it. You know, I think people are hungry for this stuff. I just think that crews of people who make hip hop and people in localities too, not to put everything on the artist, have to be more proactive about creating the opportunities for people to be able to play, right? So like, you know, like Lee Reed said in documentary, find the venues, book the venues, found the sound system. With hip hop it's not that hard, right? Because you really only need a PA and a laptop, you know,
right?
And a couple of mics. I mean, like, you don't need, you know, amplifiers. You don't need like all this shit. It's actually one of the most inexpensive and simple like setups there is. I mean, the second to last hip hop show we did here in Montreal, We did it when we launched a Trouble episode about gentrification. And we just basically went to this park without a permit. We brought a generator. We had this cheap-ass PA, this projection screen, this projector. We showed the film, and then we had like underground MCs just rock the mic, and it was awesome. And it was really, really simple. And you know, you tell some MCs who don't really have a lot of venues, you tell them, hey, well, you want to come play? Oh, you better believe they're going to be there. So, you know, it's like I said, it's not that hard, but I think we have to build it. I think we have to be proactive and do this and basically and value the fact that, you know, just because you organizing a hip hop show is as important as organizing a protest or a direct action. You know, you heard it from me.
I mean, I feel like that's a good way to end it. But do you have any final thoughts on hip hop and your film?
Yeah, I think people should screen it. People who don't know what we do at Submedia, people should go to our website, sub.media, and check it out. And the thing that we're focusing on right now is a series called Trouble, which is a monthly documentary series. And the documentary that we've been talking about this whole Soulcast is Trouble number 15. And the whole point of us making these documentaries is for people to watch them, obviously. But the one thing that we really want people to do is watch them in groups. It doesn't have to be a big community show. Even if it's just like a handful of your friends, we want to bring people outside of the isolation of the computer or the phone screen and into situations where they can get conversations going. The shows are 30 minutes long. They're pretty short. So, like, watch a film, have a conversation. And if you want to screen this one, you should couple it with some local MCs. Doesn't matter if they're, like, great or not. Just, like, you know, if you want to start up a scene in your community and there's no hip-hop scene, then what a better way to do it, you know? Just screen this film, get inspired, get a couple of your local homegrown MCs and get the party started.
That's awesome. Yeah, again, I was really inspired watching it. So I, you know, as a rapper, I thank you for making the film. I always like to ask people at the end of all my interviews, is there anything you're reading right now that you're geeking out on or a book you want to recommend?
Oh, man. Margaret Killjoy, and I can't fucking pronounce the name. I think it's Heron, A Country of Ghosts. If people don't know Margaret, I know she's been on your show. Right?
Yeah, just a couple weeks ago.
Oh, man, I got to listen to that interview. I mean, this shit is brilliant. Brilliant. Yes. If you love sci-fi and you love anarchist politics, if you miss Ursula Le Guin, Margaret is coming right on time because this book is the fucking bomb. I can't put it down.
Oh, is it it's a book that came out in physical form that you've got right now?
I have it as an e-book. I mean, if you want to talk about something that I'm geeking out, is I am really cheap with myself. I've been telling myself I was going to buy myself an ebook like 3 years ago, and I finally took the plunge and I bought the cheapest fucking ebook out there, ebook reader, and pirated books. But Margaret's I bought. Actually, there's a I can give you a link. She was passing a link. I don't know if it's still active, but it was like a crazy discount on like 10 anarchist science fiction books. So I bought them, downloaded it, put them on my Kobo, and like right before I go to sleep, I curl up to Margaret Killjoy.
Yeah, well, yeah, listen to that Soulcast, Frank. She reads this story about like a civil war in the future and Viking ghosts coming back. It really is incredible work. Yeah, right now I'm geeking out on Octavia Butler, Kindred. Have you read that?
No, shit. Fuck. But I love Octavia Butler.
Fuck, Octavia Butler, Kindred is, you know, it's harrowing. I was taking a bath reading it last night, and my wife walks in, and she's like, what the fuck are you reading? You look horrified. I'm like, I am. Oh, shit. All right, Frank. Well, hey, thanks again for taking the time to do this interview. And, yeah, everybody go check out Trouble. Film it in the new Trouble and film it, get some rappers. And if you're a rapper listening to this, fucking sharpen your politics and, you know.
Make some trouble.
is the return of the anarchists. Overthrowing governments, playing Trina's the baddest bishop. I'm not the fool, I'm not the tool of this establishment. Rip up this average cabinet full of savages. Walk many black shell shock all in my shell tops. Stingray fucking up my cell arc with co-intel ops. But still be on my chitty bang bang. Not for city tippy toe and strictly do my thing thing. Simmer, simmer, hop in the cloud like Google, smoking loud when I'm rhyming, so I'm all about the noodles. If diamonds, girls, friends, why's it always bring the shooters? We just walking in and why security pulling Rugers up? Word to Cuba, can't we all keep it tactical? Fake thugs shoot their own legs like they was Plexico. Mooses on their tracks, so we always keep it flexible. No main with vegetables, a trap intellectual. Dig it, simile, RBG, your veteran rapper, an intelligent trapper, the Confederate slapper. They mad cause we not in the field, still picking tobacco. Native from that land, I'm not Turner, I'm not a freaking actor. Be fucking up the rednecks with the southpaw. What you expect, mama, name me Ebony Outlaw. We catch a fire to the prisons and the cop cars. Real G's keep they mouth on pause. Lockjaw, shout out to Mac and Outlaw. It's time to get it on. They bout to drown the hood, we can't surf like Billabong. It ain't working, there will be no swag surfing. I never bit to apple cause I don't talk to serpents. The best be on our Facebooks, they eyeballs be lurking. Santeria, Yoruba, spit mouth full suburban. So trust the right house, guess one thing's for certain. Yell, I like the White House, you think we pull the curtains, what's up?